is the Haftorah for Parshat Chukat, which I thought would be a great thing to jump on, and the story of Yiftach, who was one of the more enigmatic leaders in Jewish history, and a real gives us a great opportunity to study a model in leadership in general. So that's what we're going to tackle. Who's with me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see the excitement. Okay, fantastic. So I'm going to share my screen. Okay, and I'm going to wait. Here it is. Okay. Can everybody see? Can you see my screen? Can you see the psukim, the chapter, the verses? Yes. Yes. No. Great.
Yes.
Because if you don't, because sometimes I'm talking to myself and I'm like, Rabbi, we're watching a YouTube channel. Okay. So we are going to. This is let's jump to. Chapter 11 in the book of Judges, right? Now, of course, Arnie will tell you, Ira will tell you, chapter 11 is always the bankruptcy chapter. So the story of Yiftach is basically, I want to say, the bankruptcy chapter of the book of Judges, but it really highlights a transitional point or the middle of the book of Judges, and sort of highlights where things transition and shift from, I want to say, good to bad, but from not great to much worse. As we'll see now, of course, it's ironic that, how many chapters are in the book of Judges? 20. So this is smack literally in the middle. This begins the second chapter, the second half of the book of Judges. And the book of Judges in general is a mess. And so what we're going to see is that Yiftach sort of shows up. There was a great article by Rav Moshe Lichtenstein on the Gush website. Yiftach sort of is the right leader in the wrong time, which is better than saying the wrong leader in the right time, right? So he would be the right leader in the wrong time, where he comes at a time where the Jewish people needed him, but he was very different from the models that preceded him. And so the challenge is to be able to sort of expand on the story while you still don't know the story yet. So we're going to, I guess we'll start with reading it. In an ideal world, I would have you read the chapter 11, and the beginning of chapter 12, I would have you read it. But we're going to try to read it quickly to each other or with each other. Just to note that chapter 11 is the story of Yiftach, and most of it is in the Haftorah, is the Haftorah for Shabbat, this coming Shabbat Parsha Chukat. And chapter 12 is the very famous Shibboleth story. Anybody know the Shibboleth story? Oh, okay. So we're going to at least have to have it. It even made a West Wing episode. These are like one of the things I was trying to figure out, like, what to teach. So I was like thinking about one of the great stories in Tanakh that we don't know. They're like famous, amazing stories, right? So before I start, does anybody know the story about the Book of Daniel and the writing on the wall? Yes, so Elliot knows it because he learned Tafyomi. So that's where they talked about. That's where he learned Tafyomi.
No, you made me learn Daniel when you did the Siyum on Tanakh.
Oh, you got the so you got Daniel. So that's how you know it, right?
It's not even in Hebrew.
No, it's in Aramaic. It's really hard. And then there's this phrase, the writing on the wall, right? That's from the Book of Daniel. It's right there. This famous phrase, the writing on the wall. But nobody knows the story. So we're gonna get to all these things. Like, there are these stories that, like, you know, I get every once in a while, I'll make a reference to this and I get humiliated that my students don't know what these things are. So, and our Jews don't know what these things are. So we'll get a chance to study them. All right. Ira, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Okay, great. So we're going to start with the Yiftach and we're going to read in English. We thank the Chabad website for providing us with this. It tells us Yiftach the Gilite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a woman of ill repute. And Gilead begat Jephthah, right? So when it says who ben isha zona, if you read the art scroll, it'll say that he was.
This says concubine in the book that I have.
Concubine, I've seen the innkeeper. Yeah,
this is the one that I have, Rabbi.
You have the art scroll, right? So okay, great. That's all. That's very nice. Art scroll is trying to cleanse it a little bit.
I mean, Zona has a definite meaning. I mean,
yes, Zona refers to the translation that we hear, even Chabad translated this way, as a woman of ill repute, a harlot. He uses the word concubine because it means, the point of it is, because it seems to be irrelevant that he was a Ben Isha Zona, except the fact that he wasn't a mainstream person, right? So normally we think of a leadership, we think of blue blood, we think of someone with yichus, right? Is the term the status.
This was David HaMelech didn't have great yichud, and Mashiach didn't either.
Right. So that he did and he didn't. David HaMelech had good yichud. Mashiach has good yichud because he comes from the Davidic line. So there is an idea of something of what we have passing over from one generation to the next, and having a status of yichus. And the Gemara has the concept of asara yuchsin, right? There were those actually interesting to note. There were people who would walk around with their papers to show their yichus, their status. And typically speaking, when you think of a person in a position of leadership, you would think of you assume someone who would be a mainstream member of society. Now, again, one of the things that we teach, and I think Elliot has been in the class that I gave, which was I have a class called the Skeletons in the Closet of the Davidic Dynasty, right? So, which goes through the David HaMelech didn't have yichus, and neither did, and Avram's father was an idolater, and Moshe's mother and father were halachically incestuous. So, yes, absolutely. And Judaism kind of takes away and says no, because Gera Eitan Be'eretz Yisrael. We were all slaves. None of us have blue blood. But nonetheless, when you're looking at a position of leadership, you're going to expect someone to come with someone to come with at least mainstream society. Yiftach is one of the primary examples of a leader who comes from absolutely out of nowhere. And really, as a Ben Isha Zonah, a son of a concubine, if you want to call her, or a woman of ill repute, right? No one would expect this guy to come anywhere, but he clearly, they're going to approach him, and because they're approaching him, it seems to be they're approaching him because he's got something that they have that they need. To note, it's important. I guess we should probably go to chapter 10 and see how things sort of end up. It's because it tells us in the verse. In the end of chapter 10, which I just jumped to, it tells us that the children of Israel, in verse 6, did was displeased the Lord, and they served Balaam, the Baal, the gods of the Baal, and the Ashtaroth, etc., gods of Aram, and the gods of the children of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. And this is where the Ammon situation is going to become relevant, right? And God became angered and delivered in the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. By the way, who is Ammon? Where are they descendants of? You're muted.
Lot. Lot.
Descendants of Lot. So we have Ammon and Moab, or descendants of Lot, and ironically come from this week's portion, which is why we're going to read the, this is a Haftorah for Parshat Chukat. The children of Ammon came and they crossed the Jordan to fight into Judah. They crushed the children of Israel that year for 18 years. I'm sorry, verse 8. They crushed and broke the children of Israel for 18 years, and the children of Israel that were beyond the Jordan of the land of Amorites, which is in Gilad, which is the Transjordan. So they're oppressing the entire area, and you have Ammon, etc., are really, really oppressing the Jewish people. Verse 13, And it says, go and cry, God, and they start crying to God, and God says, go and cry to the gods which you have chosen. Let them save you in your time of distress. And the children said to Israel, we have sinned. Do to us whatever you please, and only deliver us now on this day. And they did teshuvah, they removed the strange gods, and the people, the princes of Gilad, said to each friend, whoever shall be the man that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon, he shall be the head over the inhabitants of Gilad. Who will be our leader? Our leader will be someone, whoever is able to conquer Ammon. We are so desperate of being oppressed for all of these years, 18 years it seems to say, a whole generation, that we are desperate to find any leader. Anybody who wins this will become the leader. Now, before we get there, and again, now we're going to jump back to the story of Yiftach. Before we get there, in general, who were the leaders of the Jewish people at the time of the judges? Well, let's go through the first judge, the first leader of the, and then we translate the word shoftim as a judge because that's what it really means, but it really wasn't a shofet. It really wasn't a judge. A judge means that they answered halachic questions. They were the ones who were halachic decisors. Who was the first shofet in Jewish history? Moses. Moses is the first shofet in Jewish history. And of course, it follows that Joshua was the next one. They were the halachic decisors. What comes after that is a little unclear, right? And from the book of Judges, you'll see there were many different leaders. There was Ehud ben Gera. There was Kaleb ben Yefuna. There was Othniel ben Kenaz. Great name, by the way. And others who in the first chapters lead the Jewish people, usually for about 40 years. Now, when they lead for 40 years, incidentally, it doesn't necessarily mean that they led for 40 years. It means that they led, their leadership led for 40 years of quiet. In fact, I think it was Ehud ben Gera, where it said that he led for 80 years, right? Now, that's, you lead for 80 years, by the way. If I'm in this position for 80 years, so I'm not going to make it, trust me. let me just close the door, I'm sorry. So it doesn't really mean that he led for 80 years. It doesn't mean that they led for 40 years. It means that their leadership led to quiet and time for peace for 40 or 80 years. And who were these leaders after Joshua? Well, were they judges or were they leaders? Or were they military leaders or any under leaders? Were they military leaders or were they political leaders, right? So there are different types of leaders in general, right? We're not going to get political here, right? But there are different types of leaders in the Jewish people, and there's been different types of leaders. There are the leaders that was clear. Moshe Rabbeinu was the rabbinic leadership, right? He spoke, he was a prophet. You would say that in the model of Shmuel HaNavi, he was a prophet, and therefore he was the leader. Does Shmuel fight battles? No. Does Moshe fight battles?
No.
He does, actually, in this week's parsha. This week's parsha, Parsha Chukat, he fights against Sichon Melech Amori and Og Melech HaBashan. He fights battles. That's exactly what he does. He fights the battles through the and finally the next leader is Yehoshua, is Joshua. Does Joshua fight battles?
Yeah.
Really? Joshua fights battles.
Battle of Jericho.
Right. And even Joshua fought the Battle of Amalek. And so Yehoshua is a military leader. That's who he was, as well as he becomes a prophet and a spiritual leader.
So Yiftach is as well. It's called, he's a Gibor Chayil, right? He's a strong,
But is he a religious leader?
No, but so the word Chayil, I think, is more of a fighter, right?
He's a soldier. It's exactly it. Exactly it, Elliot. What the text is telling us right away is if Yiftach is not a religious person. Meaning, it's not that he's not a religious person, but he's not a religious leader. He's not a scholar. He's not a prophet. He also might not be a political leader. In fact, we're going to see that he doesn't have that in him. He is exactly what it says. He is a Gibor Chayil. And he is approached specifically because he is a military soldier, and he's going to, and that's what they needed at the time. And so here we see that really for the first time, we have Devorah. Devorah goes out to battle, right? And if you remember the story of Devorah, the leader of the Jewish people, the leader of the army, his name was Barak. And Devorah says to Barak, go and fight the Canaanites. And he says, listen, I'll go only if you come with me. And she goes, you want me to come with you? If I go, then you won't win anything, because even if you win, that a woman won. Because I'm not a military leader, you are, right? And he says, nonetheless, I want you to go anyway. And so she goes to him in battle. But Devorah wasn't a soldier, obviously. Devorah wasn't a soldier. So, but she was a shofetet, because the shofet was the leader of the Jewish people. But typically speaking, they weren't soldiers. Yehoshua and Moshe personified that. Kalev did as well. Othniel ben Kenaz as well. And you'll see Ehud ben Gera, and there are others that personified all these qualities. But as time progresses, you really see less and less of those qualities, really beginning with Devorah. and they share other qualities, probably qualities of leadership, and not prophecy. We just finished the story of Gidon in the previous chapters. Gidon was called a Gibor Chayil. He was also called a soldier, but God speaks to him. And here, God doesn't speak to Yiftach. So it's when Yiftach shows up on the scene, it's unclear what kind of leader. Well, it's clear what kind of leader he is. But he is a much more narrow leader than we have seen before. He is a military leader. He is not a prophet, and we're going to see that he is really not even a political leader as well. And so what we saw in the previous chapters, as we just read, finishing chapter 10, is that the people are oppressed. They don't have anybody to go to. There isn't any continuity in leadership, right? Which is, where would you find continuity in leadership? In what model? In what model of leadership would you find a continuity?
A monarchy.
You have a king.
A monarchy, right? You have a monarchy, then you know that the king is dead, long live the king. That's how it works, right? Is that the king dies, you got a new king. You don't even have an election, right? There is certainty to a certain point of who's going to be the next leader. When you don't have a monarchy here, which the model is not here in the book of Judges, is in the book of Shoftim, there is no monarchy, you don't know who the next leader is, which is good, because you don't get stuck with a bad leader. It's also bad because if you're in a position where you are in a precarious state, where there's danger, where you don't know who's going to defend you, and you're oppressed by an enemy over the last 18 years, so then you don't have anybody who's supposed to step up and be the leader. So they end up in saying, okay, whoever is going to be able to fight Ammon, they will be the leader. And so this is where we begin. It says, "V'yiftach Giladi." He was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a woman of harlot. And Gilad begot Yiftach. And Gilad's wife bore him sons, and his wife's sons grew up and drove Yiftach out. And they said to him, "You shall not inherit in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." So right away, we tell us not only doesn't he have yichus, he's an outcast even within his own family, right? But really, like, meaning even his own family doesn't treat him with prestige. Normally, at this time, for sure, we go after the family lineage, goes after the paternal lineage, right? So David HaMelech had many sons from many different wives, and doesn't seem that they had any different status because of who their mother was. Here, the family basically pushed them out. And Yiftach fled from his brothers, and he dwelt in the land of Tob. It's interesting, the Eretz Tov. I don't know what that reference is, the land of good. And idle men were gathered by and they went out with him. Now it's interesting that language, idle men, right? Which means like riffraffs, right? Which basically we would say that the people who had nowhere to go and no place to belong, that's where they ended up. They used to say this about the C.R. Wyman in Elliot.
We call them other things, actually.
Yeah. They don't belong anywhere else, so they came together, right? So
what's interesting is the Hebrew here, it says Anashim Reikim, that they were empty people.
Right, right.
Like maybe they were bad people.
So that definitely gives the connotation as well. I would agree with you that it wasn't like, you know, when we have David is really, I always see King David as the model of Robin Hood, that he would go into he would take all these outcasts, and he basically had a militia. I wouldn't say that he gave to the rich and stole from the rich and gave to the poor, but he had a militia, and the militia kind of took care of every people, you know. And so that's what you have here is you have this group that they become a militia, and they band together. Because they don't belong anywhere else, but they don't have either. They're empty emotionally, spiritually, physically, but definitely the language of Reikam is striking. Just to know, by the way, it makes sense. We see a number of cases of people who form outsiders who form militias, right? And the militias are those that basically becomes a tribe where they take care of them, where they take care of each other. And they stick together, and they don't belong to any other tribe. Remember, this is a cult at this time. right? So we mentioned David. Who else has a militia, by the way? Asaph. Asaph had 400 men that came with him. This is how tribes work. They would form this militia, or they were, depending on what they were, if they were a military tribe, but they would band together. Families usually form tribes. Here, these people didn't have families, so they banded together to form their own tribes. And because they were probably military, and that's why Yiftach had a military. Meaning they're not just showing up at Yiftach and saying, "Hi, can you save knock knock? Can you save us from this terrible army?" Yiftach already has an army. That's why they're approaching him. Make sense? Yes, except he's the head of the army. So clearly he has some certain leadership. And verse 4. And it was after many days, and the children of Ammon made war with Israel. And it was when the children of Ammon fought with Israel, and the elders of Gilead went to Yiftach from the land of Tov. And they said to Yiftach, "Come and become our chief, and we will fight with the children of Ammon. We will join you in your battle," right? We need a leader, and we need your army. And we need to fight to throw off the yoke of the people of Ammon. And Yiftach said to the elders of Gilead, "Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now that you are in distress?" Right? What he should have done is, "Well, thanks, I'm your man," right? Instead he goes, "Listen, I was an outcast, right? My family threw me out, and you basically, as you know, as the rest of the tribes, kind of just saw that happen. Right now, you're going to come to me and beg me for your help. Why? Where were you before?" And the elders of Gilead, you see. So what we first see in verse 7 is that Yiftach is sensitive. He's very sensitive, and we're going to see this later on as well. He has a certain insecurity of the fact that he was abandoned. By the way, we see this also, and then of course we always refer to the foreshadowing. There are others who have these insecurities that bring up and talk about my father and my mother, they've abandoned me, right? If you look at Psalm 27, which we read, the David Hashem Ori, King David, who also felt abandoned by his family, etc. And so it's not an uncommon role in leadership. Okay, either way. So the elders of Gilead now say to Yiftach, "We have returned," right? Remember, keep in mind, where is Gilead? Where is Gilead? Gilead's in the Transjordan, right? Gilead's in the Transjordan. And the Transjordan was the land that was taken by the Moabites at the end of the book of Bamidbar. The elders of Gilead said to Yiftach, so it's not really Israel proper. "Therefore, we return to you now, and you shall go with us, and you will fight with the children of Ammon, and you shall become our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." And Yiftach says to the elders of Gilead, "If you bring me back to fight with the children of Ammon, the Lord delivers them before me, I will become your head." And the elders of Gilead said to Yiftach, "The Lord shall hear between us. If not according to your word, so will we do." Now, what is, and Yiftach went with the elders of Gilead, and the people appointed him the head of the chief of them, and he just spoke all his words before the Lord in Mitzvah. So what I want to, I always talk about text messages. Right, and you could see it in the English, but you could see it in the Hebrew as well. In the Hebrew, I think it's more clear, but you see it in English as well. There is a something that keeps coming up with every verse that comes up with every verse that clearly is a message that the text wants us to get. In that dialogue between Yiftach and the leaders and the elders of Gilead, there's a verse that keeps coming up. What is the verse? What is the phrase that keeps coming up? Let's look at verse 8, the last words. V'haitza lanu l'rosh l'chol yoshvei Gilead. L'rosh. L'rosh. You'll become a head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Look at the end of verse 9. All right. Anoche ayah l'chem l'rosh. He said, "Okay, I'll do it if I will become your head." Right? And so they agree, "We'll do whatever you want." And then verse 11, and the people appointed him, v'yisimahem otoleim l'rosh. Something about Yiftach being the head. This was extremely important. The text is clearly trying to tell us something, that there was either A, there was a certain insecurity that Yiftach has that the people recognized, and therefore he wanted to be their head, or B, they saw this as a different model. Now, remember, as we talked on in the beginning, there are different models of leadership. Models of leadership, we have the religious model, we have the political model, and we have the military model. The people are approaching Yiftach for the military help. They say, we need your military prowess to get us out of here, because it's terrible. We need to throw off the yoke of Ammon. And so they approach him, and he says, okay, I will, but I want to be your head, right? But what does it mean? Of course they want him to be the head of the military. So what's he saying? He's saying, I don't want to be the head of the military. I want to be the head of everything. I want to make sure that if I win, you're not going to just say, hey, thanks, you were the great military leader. We appreciate it. We're going to send a set of days for you, and we'll celebrate. Want to make sure that that I remain the head of the Jewish people even after this process. You could understand this. Now, Yiftach is an outsider. He has been. First thing he says is, hey, where were you when they threw me out and now you're coming to me? Right? He said, I've been thrown out. But he's basically saying, if I am reestablishing myself as the leader of the entire Jewish nation, I will never be in that position as I was before. And the whole people, at least the people of Gilad, but the whole, you will recognize me as your political, perhaps religious, and definitely military leader. I want everything, right? Yiftach wants to be the whole package. And the people...
Maybe he's insecure also because the Zikne Gilad didn't apologize for what they did. When he said, aren't I the hated one? You threw me out. They didn't say, oh, we're sorry. He said, no, we're getting beat up by the Ammonites. Come and help us.
You know,
it's sort of self-serving, right? So maybe he felt that's exactly... that he's being hired as sort of like a mercenary. Come help us and then you're done.
You know, I'm wondering why, whether the fact that... okay, yeah. So because it says the elders of Gilad, it sounds like these are the elders of that family tribe. So it's really his family who are approaching him. In other words, Yiftach's father, Yiftach HaGiladi, Gilad must have been a pretty important person in that area. So otherwise it doesn't make sense. I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. That they were the aristocrats of the neighborhood. They threw him out, and which happens often in leadership. And he basically says, "I want to be the head of your family, and I want to be the head of the whole area." He has a tremendous insecurity given what happened to him before, and a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. Okay, let's jump. So. The first thing, and this is, I'm going to fly through this because it's a little less relevant, although this is exactly the connection to the parasha, but doesn't necessarily tell us so much about Yiftach. It tells us in verse 12, at the end of verse 11, it says that Yiftach spoke his words before the Lord in Mitzpah. And in other words, he went to pray. Now, Mitzpah, by the way, is a place where is often the people go to pray. We'll see later on in the book of Shmuel. And Yiftach then sent messengers to the king of children of Ammon saying, what is between me and you that have come to me in fight of my land? Right. In other words, what does Yiftach do before he goes to fight? He sends diplomatic messengers and says, hey, let's, we don't have anything between us. Why should we be fighting? Right. Incidentally, if we go back to the Parsha, and this is exactly the connection of the Parsha, that's exactly what Moshe does. Moshe, Yiftach takes his model of leadership that he's trying to emulate from Torah. And he looks at Moshe, he has the Torah, and he looks at Moshe's story, and Moshe does exactly that. He sends messengers to Ammon and to Moab and says, hey, can we play through? Listen, we have no beef with you. We just want to pass by, won't take anything, and let us go through because you're family, because you're a distant relative, right? What was Ammon and Moab's response, incidentally, to Moshe? They said to him, they immediately attacked, and because of that became an important halakha, and that halakha is that you cannot take an Ammonite or a Moabite to marry within the nation of the Jewish people, which is of course where the whole story of Ruth comes in as a real question and challenge, because Ruth is a Moabite, a Moabiyah, and so is she allowed to be married in? And the conclusion from the oral tradition was it was only the males and not the females. because the males went around and attacked the Jews when the females weren't. They're not the ones who wage war; they're the ones who sit at home. And so therefore they weren't held responsible. But the Ammonites and Moabites, they became really this nemesis. In the Jewish people and Jewish lore, they became the epitome of cruelty. Because here we were family and we just wanted to go through. You should have brought us food, drink, whatever it is, and say, sure, you know, stay for lunch. And instead you attacked us instead. But Moshe starts this with the diplomatic model, which is the right thing to do, right? Which is the right thing to do. And of course, who does that before that? We have Yaakov. Yaakov sends, when he's about to face his brother, he sends Malachim, he sends messengers with presents. Yes. And says, yeah, let's, we're brothers. What do we need to fight? And so Yiftach is showing this is actually a political move, right? Now, just before we referred to as an Anshei Chayil, right? What does he know? He's a missionary. He's a militant, right? He's not a missionary. He's a militant. He's a militia. He comes and he attacks, right? They tell him to attack. He says, point me in the direction and I'll go kill people, right? But instead, he's showing a certain amount of diplomatic skills, and that are at least attempting to, which is his way of showing, displaying leadership, just like it says in the book. That's what Moshe did. And so the king of the children of Ammon said to the messengers of Yiftach, verse 13, because Israel took away my land and they came out of Egypt from Ammon and up to the Yabok and up to the Jordan, and now restore them peacefully. Give us back our land and we won't bother you. Right? Now, what is, is that true?
They weren't a Canaanite nation, were they?
They were Ammon and Moab. This is they were really the nation of the by the Transjordan. They're the Transjordan. So Ammon says, "Listen, you took our place up to the Jordan. You took it by up to, and now we want our land back. You stole it from us, right?" And Yiftach says, "What do you think? We didn't steal it from you." Verse 15. So said Yiftach, Israel did not take the land of Moab and the land of the children of Ammon. We came from Egypt and we went from the wilderness of the sea and they came to Kadesh. And Israel sent messages to the king of Edom saying, let me pass now through your land. And the king of Edom did not listen. And also the king of Moab, he said, and he was unwilling. And Israel abode in Kadesh. And they went through the wilderness and went through the land of Edom. It was very long, very verbose, right? And the land of Moab, and they came to the land of the east of Moab and they camped on the side of the Arnon. And they did not come to the border of Moab. For the Amno and the border of Moab, and Israel sent messengers to Sichon, which is Sichon Melech Amori of the right, as well as the king of Og Melech Habashan of the king of Heshbon, and Israel said to them, let us pass through land to our place. Sichon did not trust Israel to pass to the border, and Sichon gathered his people and they camped in Yaz and he fought with Israel. And the Lord, the God of Israel, delivered Sichon and his people in the land of hand of Israel, and they struck him, and Israel possessed the land of the Amorites and the inhabitants of the land. And they possessed the borders of the Amorites, from the Arnon up to the Yavok, from the wilderness up to the Jordan. And now the Lord, the God of Israel, has driven out the Amorites from before his people, and you want to possess it? So Yiftach's response is, this is called revisionist history, right? We didn't take it from you. We came peacefully. And what did you do? You attacked us. And after you attacked us, we won this land fair and square. And now you're going to complain to us and say that we stole it from you? I mean, how would anybody possibly do that? Is there anybody in history who's ever done something like that? Yes, right today, the same thing is happening. History repeats itself. This is exactly what happened to the land in Israel, is that Israel has a land, Israel is coming, they come in peace, they get attacked, Israel wins a war, and then they say, wait a second, why did you attack us? And we want our land back, pre-67, pre-48, pre-everything, right? This is Jewish history repeating itself right here and there from these verses. So Yiftach's response is, that's ridiculous. This is not real. And he continues to speak, and I'm just going to, he says to Ammon, verse 27, I have not sinned against you. I do no wrong with fighting against me. The Lord judge decide this day between the children of Israel and the children of Ammon. I am so right. I am so right that God's going to prove this to him, right? And here we have this phrase in verse 29. Everybody with me so far? I'm sorry, verse 28, and the king of children of Israel did not listen to the words of Ammon, which of Yiftach, which he sent him and said, we're going to, you want it? Come and get us, right?
Where is Transjordan?
The Transjordan is Me'ever HaYarden. It's before the Jordan River. So if you see the map, everybody see the map?
I don't have a map. The map that you've been getting for years?
Yeah, the map I've been getting for years. I don't have a map. Yeah, so when Israel is coming, they enter the land through Jericho, right? That's where they enter in that area. And so before that is in Jericho, you see there's the Jordan River runs through Jericho. Right now, if you go to Jericho, you see the Jordan River. It's about the size of my computer. It's like you can really leap over the whole thing. But that's the Jordan River. Apparently, it was longer back then. On the other side of the Jordan River is the Transjordan. Right? When they're coming from the Sinai, that's where the land is. So if you remember the 2.5 tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh, they take over that land after it's really pre-Israel, because it wasn't the Israel borders. They're living in that land first. After Joshua crosses the border of Jordan and then he goes into Jericho, etc., that's when they are starting to conquer the land of Israel. Did I answer your question, your short question, in a very long? Pretty much. Okay, so here, any other questions we have so far? Great. So it tells us that it says, if you, so Yiftach is saying, okay, I'm going to fight you because this is and after making diplomatic overtures, they're not interested, and here we have this phrase that's quite an important phrase, because we're going to see that it means a lot of different things. Vayitihi al Yiftach, verse 29, Vayitihi al Yiftach ruach Hashem. And Yiftach had the Spirit of God. The Spirit of the Lord was upon Yiftach. And he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed over Mitzvah of Gilead, and from Mitzvah of Gilead, he passed over to the children of Ammon. So he goes in and he starts waging war as he travels through the land. Now, this phrase, Ruach Hashem, means a whole lot. It could mean that he received prophecy. It could mean he received inspiration. It could mean that he felt so connected to God that he made an oath that he is now a religious leader. It's unclear, and how we interpret those words really help us understand Yiftach a little bit. But if you ask me, I think Yiftach is a little bit out of his league. In other words, he's feeling a certain spirituality he's not worthy of, or is he's not a vessel for. Let's look what it says. Immediately after he starts this war, it says, Yiftach vowed a vow. This is known as Yiftach Neder, Yiftach's vow. And to the Lord and said, if you will indeed deliver the children of Ammon into my hand, it will be whenever it comes forth that shall come forth from the doors of my house towards me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall do to the Lord, and I will offer it for a burnt offering. Of course, what is Yiftach assuming? He's going to show up and his favorite cow is going to, Nelly is going to, or Elsie, is going to welcome him home. And he'll say, Elsie, thanks to you, thanks to the Lord, I'm going to bring you as a sacrifice and everything will be great. The problem with that vow is that it could be anything, right? His dog could show up and say, hey, you know, hey, say to his owner, I don't know if you've had a dog. And of course, what ends up happening is who shows up?
Daughter?
His daughter shows up, right? And so, and here you have that confusion. Let's go through very quickly. It tells us that Yiftach, verse 33, he struck down, the whole battle is one verse. He struck down from Er until it came to Minna, 20 cities, and then very slaughter, and the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. Yiftach wins hands down. And Yiftach came to Mitzpah to this house, and behold, verse 34, his daughter was coming out towards him with timbrels and with dances. Right? Where have we seen the women with timbrels and dances?
Miriam.
Miriam Yofi. Very nice, Ira. Right? So apparently after a battle, right, that was the thing that the women would celebrate with music and instruments. And she was an only child, and he had from her neither a son nor a daughter. And it was when he saw her that he rent his clothes, and he said, alas, my daughter, you have made me fall, and you have become one of those that trouble me. And I have opened my mouth to the Lord that I cannot go back. He said to him, my father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord, do not to me according to that which has issued from your mouth, because the Lord has done for you a vengeance from your enemies, from the children of Ammon. And she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Rain for me for 2 months, and I shall go, and a wall upon the mountain, and I shall crawl right over my virginity, and I and my companions. And he said, oh, sent her away for 2 months. She went to her companions, she over her virginity upon the mountain. It doesn't mean that she really cried for being a virgin. She cried that she didn't have any children yet. And he gave her a 2 month reprieve. At the end of the month, she returned to her father, and he did to her his vow, which he had vowed, and she had not known any man, and it was his statute in Israel. And for years to years, the daughter of Israel went to lament the daughter of Yiftach the Gilite for days in a row. So the story of it's like this wacky, like, what the heck is going on? Yiftach shows up, he sees his daughter, and he goes, I can't, it's terrible. I can't retract my oath. Right now, because I made this promise to God, and so it seems to be very clearly. Although the commentaries discuss whether or not he did actually kill her or not, because it doesn't say that in the text. Some say he just left her up in a monastery, and that she couldn't, because it keeps mentioning her virginity, that she became the chastity belt thing that they whatever. So he basically sent her up to be to never know a man, and therefore you wouldn't have any children, and that would be the equivalent. But the pshat seems to say clearly that he killed her, right? And this was a terrible tragedy. The question is that was there anything Yiftach could have done? He made this oath. He made an oath. You got to keep your oath. A promise is a promise. Isn't that correct?
He could have gone to a Talmid Chacham to find a petach. Say, look, I didn't consider that she was gonna. And that should have done it.
What do we call that?
So I called a petach, an opening.
It's called hatarat nedarim. Exactly. The petach, an opening refers to, is that there were circumstances that I wasn't aware of, and that if I would have been aware of, I wouldn't have taken that oath. Right? That's the petach. That's the opening. And what you have to do is you have to go in front of three, generally they're rabbis, but they don't have to be rabbis. And they have to say, you say this whole thing, and you say, I didn't know. If I would have known, I would have made this oath. And so if I would have known the circumstances, I would have made the oath. New things have opened up my eyes and made me realize that it was a poor oath. And therefore, I'm not responsible for the oath. And they respond, mutter lach, mutter lach, mutter lach. Fine, don't worry, you could do it. Which we do this for Hatarat Nedarim before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, yes.
So maybe this is your proof that he wasn't a religious guy. Maybe he didn't know about that rule.
Well, it's not that he wasn't a religious guy. It's he was an uneducated person. He didn't know this rule. That's the first thing, right? The other part of this is he says that he did know the rule, right? Well, because all that somebody has to do is go over to him and say, but the real question is, where are the leaders? Why aren't the rabbis going along and saying, hey, Yiftach, by the way, don't worry about it. We got an open. We can get him out of it. You don't have to do this, right? I mean, not only that, he's going to kill his only daughter, right? He's going to kill his only daughter. It's a terrible thing, right? So why didn't the rabbis say anything? So it could be that they did say something. There are two approaches. One approach is the rabbis didn't say anything because they were afraid of Yiftach, right? Which is hard to say that they were afraid of him because he didn't show any mean spirit. We're going to see in a moment that he does, if you look at chapter 12, but at least up till now, it doesn't seem he shows any mean spirit to his own people, right? So the other approach could be that they didn't say something to him, or people said things to him, and he didn't listen. And why didn't he listen? Why would he not give an opportunity to say, what we call it, what you said, referred to as a petach, to say, well, I didn't know, or I wasn't aware, or it's, you know, I'm nullifying my vow.
Maybe he bit off more than he can chew when he said he wanted to be the Rosh of everything.
Yes.
And that they, if you want to be the leader of everything, we're not going to come and challenge what you're doing.
So that could be, but, so one is that he just didn't know. He just didn't know. That's a possibility. The other possibility is he did know, and yet he still did not revoke his vow or annul his vow. And remember, let's keep in mind the story of Purim for a second. In the story of Purim and Achashverosh, Achashverosh sends out a proclamation. The proclamation is that the Jews are supposed to be killed on the 13th day of Adar. Correct? Now, Achashverosh finds out that Haman has planned this whole thing, and he believes that Haman is trying to assassinate him and take over his monarchy, etc., etc. And really, it was all Haman's fault. And so what should he do? He should send a proclamation and say, sorry, I made a mistake. I was wrong. The Jews are fine. Don't worry about it. What does he do? He doesn't do that. Why doesn't he do that? What does he do instead? He sends another proclamation. And the proclamation is that Jews are able to defend themselves. And he gives them weapons to defend themselves. And as it turns out, they were actually able to defend themselves so well that they killed 75,000 enemies, and not a single of them fell, according to the Gemara, but it does say that they killed 75,000 people at the time, right? So why doesn't Achashverosh just say, oh, listen, I made a mistake? Because kings don't do that. Kings don't make mistakes.
Right.
And so what we're seeing with Yiftach, perhaps, is, and he recognizes that, listen, I made an oath to God, which, by the way, so did all the kings. The kings made oaths to their gods, non-Jewish, and kings made oaths to their gods. The first thing they would do is they would bring sacrifice to their gods, the god of Ishtar and the god of Merodach, which is always ironic that the Persian gods of Mordechai and Esther are Ishtar and Merodach, which is clearly wasn't their names. It was the names of the Persian gods, right? So it wasn't a crazy thing that he said, I made an oath to my God, therefore I'll bring a sacrifice to my God. All religions did this. All cultures did this. And I want to propose, and I think there's a lot of validity to it, is Yiftach, who's trying to establish himself as the Rosh, as the head. I am the big shot. As the big shot, I don't make mistakes. You can't annul my vow. My vow is my vow. My word is my word. And therefore, there is no compromise on this. And that becomes part of the tragedy. And so here you have that it's fascinating. As I said, the story of leadership, we only have a few minutes to get to chapter 12, which is, I just want to highlight. But the story of the leadership, you have Yiftach, he's not really ready for prime time. He's not ready to be the leader. And for sure, the people aren't ready to accept him ready to have him as their leader. They needed a military leader at the time. They needed somebody to... And if there was a king, the king would have taken over. It's interesting to note, I didn't get into it, but the end of chapter, the end of chapter 10 or the middle of chapter 10, it tells us that there were some of the children started taking over for the leadership of their fathers. And that was like the first time that was happening. Until then, you didn't have that. Yiftach, who has no children, who has no leadership, who doesn't come from anybody, becomes this leader, absent of anybody from before who would follow him. And he says, I want to be the guy in every way, shape, and form. And the people weren't ready for that. It's important to note, and I'll just, I want to just highlight it, because the most pivotal point one of the pivotal points in Jewish history is the end of chapter 8 with someone by the name of Gidon. Gidon is the leader of the Jewish people, and where is it? Sorry. Right here, verse 22. Gidon is the leader of the Jewish people. He is one of the most successful. It's called the Gibor Chayil. He is a soldier. He has prophecy. It's huge. And after he has this military victory, it says the men of Israel, verse 22, said, Gidon, rule over us, both you and your son and your son's sons, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. We want a king right now. And if we have a king, then your children will take over when you take over. We won't have a vacuum of leadership every couple of generations. And we don't have anybody who's gonna defend us and rule over us. And not just rule, who will defend us, who will lead us in a hostile area. And Gideon's response says, I shall not rule over you, and my son shall not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. All this is a very nice idea, by the way. And incidentally, it's this verse, these verses, and the verse, and it's a little bit of a side note, but these verses and the Haftorah from last week of Shmuel and the chapter that precedes it of that, when the people approach him to have a king, and he says it's a terrible idea, that was actually the basis for Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which was basically this pamphlet was attributed for inspiring the American Revolution. Elliot, do you know what the American Revolution is? I'm sorry. always take an opportunity. But Gidon says, I won't rule over you. I can't rule over you. Because that leads to really a long period of decades and decades of a lack of leadership. And the Jewish people wondering, who follows Yiftach, incidentally? Pretty much, although there are a couple of small leaders in the middle. But the one who follows is Shimshon, who is a leader without any followers. And really a very strange individual. Just to note, we only have one more minute left, is that I wanted to, that the next scene, if you do me a favor, just do me a favor and just, you know, tell me you'll do it. And even if you don't, just lie to me. It's okay. I'll forgive you. If you read chapter 12, you can read the Shibboleth story, where it tells us a little bit more about Yiftach as well. There's a civil war and they kill out many, many members of, basically for those who, Ephraim shows up and says, hey, why do you get all the spoils of war? We would have fought with you also. And he says, what are you talking about? You didn't fight with us. Where were you? And so they went and attacked the people of Ephraim. And the people of Ephraim were so afraid, the tribe of Ephraim was so afraid, that, and they also had an accent. So they would have them say the word Shibboleth, Shibboleth. And if they said it like with th, that's when they knew they were from Ephraim. Ephraim apparently had a dialect, and how they pronounce things. And so whatever. It's a famous, as I said, it's a famous story. It's worth reading just to get to understand the last parts of Yiftach. And so to conclude, I think Yiftach was a leader. It would have been a leader that was necessary at the time, but he wasn't ready for prime time, and the people weren't ready for him either. So he becomes very much a tragic figure, and that leads really to the downfall of leadership of the people. You have Shimshon that follows, and then the end of the book of Judges has five chapters which deal with the Pesel Micha, which is idolatry. It's another story. You should read it if you're not familiar with it. And the Pilegesh of Giva, which is, again, basically the downfall of society of idolatry, adultery, and murder. And those two stories, because they don't have leadership. And that really blows up in chapter 11 with the story of Yiftach. So we thank you for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, there we are. Ah, David, I missed you. Hi, David. So we thank you. We thank everybody for joining us. I hope we had a good time. The Book of Judges is like just you can get lost in it. There's so much going on there, and each story feeds on each other. So, as I like to say, in order to understand Tanakh, you have to know all of Tanakh. So you got to really read the whole thing, and then you can start studying and get a better understanding of it. All
right. That's right.
We wish everybody a great day. Stay dry wherever you are, okay? Take care, everyone.
Take care.
Elliot, it's great to see you.
You as well. I really enjoyed this. I'm going to try Bli Nedr to catch it every week.
It's nice. If not, I'm putting it on Facebook these days, so you can...
That's how I sort of found out about it.
Oh, okay.
Last week, I saw Rabbi Eben is on live. So I jump on, it was like,